This is Icon Art Radio. I'm Bill Teeple. I'm here with my co-host, Alan Cobb. And our special guest today is Barry Ross, who has a very remarkable and special sculpture sitting at Icon Gallery right now as part of our Icon Invitational. It's a great story. It's a great special work of art, very unique. And we're going to have Barry talk about it a little bit today.
I just have to say, somehow saying that it's sitting at Icon Gallery doesn't sound right to me.
It's on display.
Yeah, or it's dominating Icon Gallery. It's a magnificent thing that's not just come to the gallery and see an odd piece of clay on a pedestal.
No, it's installed. Is it 6 feet high on the pedestal or
from
on
the
its
floor
own?
To the top of the sculpture? Is just a bit over 6 feet.
Basically, yeah. It is dwelling. Presiding over the show. Let's put it that way. But it's on a beautiful plinth made by Duncan McMaster, and the piece is a double trunked piece of red oak. Mm-hmm. And let me just say a word or two about Barry before we go on to the sculpture. Barry is a nationally known, has been for how many years have you been doing illustration?
Probably 45.
45 years he's been doing, he's been nationally known as an illustrator for many magazines, but notably Aviation Magazine, is that right?
Golf Magazine.
Yeah, and his works are on permanent display in the Aviation Museum or some museum?
The Air Venture Museum in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, which is the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association. There's a gallery that features my aviation paintings. So
he's like, when you just see his work, you know, this guy is one of those illustrators that there aren't that many left anymore. Is it a dying field, or is computer taking over? This is a whole show in itself. So let's. Say a word or two about it.
Illustration has changed without question, so that probably 85% is now done on the computer rather than, by hand. Although there are still many illustrators, particularly those that do children's books, who still work in the old-fashioned pen and ink and watercolor or what have you. But the preponderance of work that's out there today is being done on the computer.
But just as with what I teach, which is oil painting and those hands-on techniques, it's something that will never go away completely. There'll always be, I think, some demand for that look and that style and that hands-on personal touch.
Yeah, I would agree. And I don't think the computer programs as yet have really managed to create the look of a really beautiful wash that has accidents, or the kind of feelings of a croquel pen on paper. They come close in some instances, but...
I just think that there's a certain nuance to those materials that doesn't get through. This is that digital, a little bit difference between analog and digital in the recording industry.
It's really a huge difference between, shall we say, real and virtual. Yes, you're actually putting pigments onto a medium of some kind, and the range of possibilities in pigment and texture and reflectivity is 10,000 times greater than what you can do inside a computer on a display. That is simply, it's a backlit medium, like it or not. And when you print it out, it looks less lively. And you're limited by the gamut of inks and inkjet printers and things, and they are excruciatingly limited compared to reality.
You know, a lot of it is driven by that it's less expensive for a publication to download a digital illustration than it is for them to, get the original, scan it, do whatever they have to do to have it appropriate.
You mean economics are involved?
Yeah, of course. that's true. But
all right, well, let's talk about after 45 years of being a major illustrator, you've made a significant career change. You have sort of gone for your heart's desire, it seems, mm-hmm. to do wood sculpture. And I've seen you shifting over in the last few years. But the major work that you've produced is Awakening, which is at the gallery right now. Now, when did you start doing Awakening? Because I heard a rumor that you started on that 13 years ago.
Well, more accurately. I should preface this by saying that I did sculpt in wood 45 years ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I did one piece in Mexico on mesquite, and I loved it. I had such a good time, and I still have the piece in my studio. And then pretty much didn't do anything for years because I was building the illustration career. At one point, I did take a course in wood carving, but the only thing I learned in that course was how to sharpen my tools.
Well, that's quite an art in itself.
You know, although that was good. Yeah. You know? And then, when I first arrived here in Fairfield, I did a base for the sculpture that I had done in Mexico, and that was out of silver maple, and it was the base of a tree trunk that I turned upside down, so that where the roots went in the ground was now facing up like mm-hmm. a flower, and that was a lot of fun, and that was at least, that had to be 15 years ago, and then again nothing, and then about 13 years ago, that magic number, Kate and I, my wife, were bicycling around town, and we noticed a large double trunk, I didn't know what kind of wood it was, lying in the grass of someone's backyard, which was huge. And the fellow was out there, and Kate said, "Aren't you looking for a tree trunk that you could, you know, carve?" And I said, "Yeah, I am." And he said, "Well, let's go talk to him." And he was quite surprised that I wanted this, you know, behemoth of a tree trunk. And he said, if you can get it out of this backyard, you can have it. And I'll even remove my fence. And I said, you remove the fence, I'll have it out of here in an hour. And I called up Fairfield Lumber. They sent over a skid loader, mm-hmm. loaded it up, and brought it back to our house. So I got the wood. And of course, you can't just start carving a piece of wood that's been lying out in the open for probably 6 months or a year. It was all rotted on one side. And I stood it up in the garage. I didn't have my studio yet. And debarked it. That's the first thing you do. And then I cleaned out all of the rot. And then you really have to let it dry.
Yeah.
You know, you can't just start carving it. And so there was a period of about 4 or 5 years that it just sat in the studio mm-hmm. with me thinking about it. And I kept noticing where I had cleaned out the rotted portion, that there were all these bumps that had been left behind, and they reminded me of heads. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, gee, it's almost like a whole series of heads rising up through this piece of wood, and they are kind of surrounded by the edge of the wood. It was like what remained of the edges of the wood came out further than the bumps, and it felt as if they were protected or within a skin. And I got the feeling of, well, gee, there's like a whole world within this little envelope. And that's when I started to get the idea, well, gee, maybe this would be an interesting way of showing reincarnation, a series of heads rising up through the wood, and that the part of the wood that was surrounding it or protecting it was Maya, or the illusion of life, mm-hmm. so that the whole thing was taking place within the illusion of life. And the wood itself was remarkable. It had a very sensual shape to it. It wasn't just a straight tree trunk. It had a bulbous, it almost looked pregnant. And at the largest, what would you call it, the most profound side, there was this hole that had once been a branch that went right to the middle of the sculpture. And all around there were places that had access to the center, which was pretty much hollow in between and rose from the bottom of the tree to the very top. And so little by little, I started working on reinforcing those shapes and starting to develop some of the heads. And so probably in that 13-year period, starting maybe 5 years ago, when I had the time, and I would take a week now or a week then and keep developing it. until I had the rough sculpture, and there were two figures on the other side that I felt I wanted to show the synchronicity of soulmates in the process of ascending from this dimension to another, moving from the solidity of what they felt was solidity, in that they were surrounded by the Maya. They were actually in the clutches, so to speak, and continued to work on it now and then. I couldn't find the time to really devote the attention that it needed. And then about 2 years ago, with the change in the economy, there was a change in my clientele, and I suddenly found that I had a lot of time on my hands. And I realized that two things. One, I had gotten tired of illustrating. After so many years, I didn't want to draw another golfer for the rest of my life. And I still loved airplanes, but even that was kind of fading, in terms of what turned me on. And I knew the sculpture really turned me on. And so I'd say a good 18 months or 2 years ago, I did what I had to do in terms of illustration, but just started working every day on the sculpture. And it was also interesting in that I had carved the first piece I had ever done in Mexico, which was mesquite, is one of the forms of ironwood. It's a very, very hard wood. Mm-hmm. And I worked with, the only tools I had at the time was a straight chisel and a ball peen hammer. Mm-hmm. I subsequently found out that worked on the ironwood because it was so hard, but on the softer wood it wasn't going to work. You had to really develop technique with gouges and the mallet and so on. Red oak is almost as hard. You cannot take a gouge or a chisel and with your hands push it through the wood. I don't care how strong you are, it won't go. So I started to think about I had purchased lots of different tools. And I had purchased two grinders that are made in Australia that I had gone to some woodcraft shows. And these were phenomenal tools, especially for hardwood, in that they were so precise and sharp and versatile that I could carve the red oak no problem. Not for little details, but for the roughing major shapes, roughing it out and so on. And then I would return to the gouges and the mallet to do the details, still not finished, but still pretty close. And then I had it's called a Forsdom. It's it's like a dentist drill with a foot pedal and a big motor on an arm. Mm-hmm. And there are different heads that go on it so that you can grind, you can sand, you can cut in very small spaces. Mm-hmm. And I use that to do more of the finished parts. And then even sanding by hand didn't do anything. It really, you could sand all day and nothing would happen. But I developed a way of using my drill and a disc sander. I was quite surprised at how much detail I could get just from that disc, turning it on its edge and so on.
Yeah.
And so it was quite a learning experience as far as the tools. And I found that within a few weeks, I was totally comfortable with the tools and they would do what I wanted to have done. I didn't have to think about them. And so I could really be totally focused on what I was carving rather than the process of carving. Mm-hmm. And that in itself had a life of its own, because things would happen in the wood that you didn't expect or you don't foresee.
Well, it seems like you're very much sort of working with the wood and that there's this dialogue going on between
Absolutely.
You and the wood.
The wood, and the wood would play tricks. I think I had told you, Bill, about doing one of the heads in the sculpture, a biblical woman. And I just was working on the nose, and boom, it came off. There was no nose anymore because there was a little flaw that I couldn't see in the grain. All right, I wasn't upset. I just felt, there's a different head that's supposed to be here.
Yeah.
Or you come across
the noseless incarnation.
Right.
A skull, perhaps.
Well, one would come, you know, I would come across rot that I didn't expect.
Yeah.
You know, there'd be a whole area of what's called punky wood inside a perfectly good layer of wood, and then behind it would be this this stuff that you just couldn't carve, you know, and so it had to be cleaned out. And that actually added to the drama of the sculpture and to the feeling of the figures coming out of the sculpture and being very much a part of it rather than like an applique or a surface.
No, they feel like they're emerging from the wood, and the wood itself is a beautiful abstract experience.
I know.
Just on the level of sensual and aesthetic experience.
Yeah, it flows and it has this,
and it glows with that reddish
energy.
Tone.
I know the color is magnificent and the grain is so exciting.
Yeah.
And what was interesting for me is that when I was carving it originally, I hadn't oiled it yet. And so the color was really 20% of what it turned out to be when after it was oiled.
Yeah.
So the grain didn't even stand out particularly.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing the figure of the woman, I remember I was doing her breasts. I wasn't paying attention to the grain particularly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but when I finished and looked at it, and particularly after I oiled it, I realized that there were concentric rings on the breast, starting at the nipple and working back. It was so, you know, and people would say to me when they saw it, how did you do that? How did you plan to do that?
Yeah.
And I said, I didn't. You know, it just happened.
Yeah.
So
I might say to our listening audience, in case someone just tuned in, flipped us on in the car, that we are interviewing Barry Ross, who is becoming a wood sculptor, and he's talking about his piece Awakening that's at Icon Gallery right now.
And I should mention that it's mid-December 2010, in case you're listening to
right. Sometimes we repeat these shows, and so if you're hearing this in 2013, or just putting it, you know, listening to it off our playlist, it's not. It may not be. It probably is not at Icon Gallery anymore. But we do hope that Icon Gallery still exists.
There we go.
Well, I think it's great that the tree came from town too. It's not just some piece of wood that you found at a sculpture supply shop someplace.
Yeah,
it's actually a piece of the local landscape that has developed into something transcendental.
I've been thinking lately of going back to the house and seeing if the present owner is still the same person that gave me the tree trunk.
Let's see what you know,
and then show him what happened to it.
I'm curious about the grinders you mentioned. I believe there's an Australian grinder that I've seen, which is a pair of counter-rotating saw blades. They're like 5-inch diameter blades, and they spin. They're right next to each other, and they spin in opposite directions.
No, this is not like that.
Okay,
it's based on a Makita side grinder.
Mm-hmm.
Which means that the grinding wheel is on the front side, but toward the front of the grinder. And what the way this grinder was designed, there are two forms of it. One, it replaces the wheel that is a metal grinder that's on the grinder already with a disc, and then in the face of the disc are three what would you call them? Discs. Tiny discs, slightly concave, that face forward, and they're exceedingly sharp. Mm-hmm. And then there are the cutting edges, you know, when it spins, that actually scoops the wood. And then after using it for, let's say, 2 or 3 hours, you then loosen a little set screw, and you rotate it a quarter turn, and you now have another sharp edge.
Yeah. Interesting.
And then there's a smaller version, which attaches an arm with a little belt on it, which leads to a smaller disc. Maybe it's an inch and a half in diameter, and that has two little cutting edges on it, and also works the same way.
Interesting.
Yeah,
I haven't seen those. I've noticed in recent years several innovative, interesting, kind of highly developed power tools coming from Australia that are just different from everything else I've seen. They have some innovative tool. I guess there's a certain amount of self-sufficiency still going on there, and people work on a tool in their garage for 20 years until they get it just the way they want it, and eventually, we're lucky, it ends up as a product.
Well, these particular tools, you know, Arbitech is the name of the company, is well represented in the United States, and there's distribution and and so on.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of the counter-rotating saw thing. Mm-hmm. But it's a remarkable tool because it has no pull. It doesn't.
Yeah.
You can push it up against something, and it just goes right into it.
Yeah.
So you can twist it around.
It's the same with the with the Arbitech tools. Mm-hmm. And in fact, when I'm doing, when I was developing the flow of what of the Maya of the of those shapes, you know, there was some very convoluted and twisting kind of elements in it, almost like smoke rising or tendrils, or you know. And if I were to try and do that with gouges, you'd have to change the gouge for every curve.
Yeah.
You know, and you'd have to be working in a way that you were absolutely aware of the grain so that you didn't split the wood.
Yeah.
And with these grinders, I could actually just press it in and then move it up and twist it sideways.
Yeah.
And it would create these wonderful shapes. I mean, it was just that's cool. Phenomenal. So,
so where are you going from here?
Well, interestingly enough, in my relationship with the town of Fairfield and its supply of wood, as a you know, parenthetically, I have within my garage, which is a good sized garage, one side of it is has at least a dozen tree trunks that are that have been drying now for 8 or 10 years, including silver maple, and have a complete cherry tree, and have some walnut and some other woods, including the root balls. You know, these wonderful, almost Medusa-like shaped. You know, the roots of the trees themselves. And from what I understand from Duncan McMaster, he says, wait till you start cutting those root balls. He says, the grain is so bizarre down there. It's much different than normal grain. So some of those are starting to attract my attention in terms of wanting to sculpt them. You know? However, in the meanwhile, about a year ago, a friend, Bill Godfrey, who was, had moved into town temporarily from out, he lived further, you know, west in town, was staying someplace where they had cut down a cherry tree maybe 6 or 8 months before. And in the backyard was, the cherry tree had a burl as part of the tree. For those of you that don't know what a burl is, it is a growth on the tree. You'll see it as a bump on the tree. It just looks oddly different. And it can actually, this particular burl, as a growth, it also has different grain. It doesn't have the same grain as the original tree because it's essentially a tumor.
Yeah.
And the cells of the wood are actually, have been altered in some way, you know, by, they don't even know how it occurs, but it's similar to a tumor growing. And this cherry tree, which is no more than 12 inches in diameter, had a burl around it, completely surrounding it, that was 30 inches in diameter.
Wow.
I mean, it was huge. And it was, maybe 18 or 20 inches in depth. And there it was sitting in the backyard. And burls have very interesting, almost marbleizing grains. And I didn't know it at the time, since it still had bark on it. It also had what's called spalting. Spalting is, it looks like someone took ink and dripped it on the wood in little dots and little lines and little shapes. And the color within one shape will be different than the color of on the outside of it. And it's so interesting looking, and bowl makers love burls. They love making bowls out of burls.
Yeah.
And so I got this wood and I debarked it, and then I saw all the spalting. And I was just amazed, and I have started sculpting that.
Oh, great.
So it will also have a kind of divine element to it. And awakening is really about reincarnation and about ascendancy and evolution. And this new sculpture will be about the divine energy that creates us. Mm-hmm. And because within the burl, what I felt and saw was a vortex starting with the center of the wood. Mm-hmm. And so I'm developing those vortices. Mm-hmm. And they will be the primary shapes and so on. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting. At the end of each vortices, at the end of each flow, will be a head. Mm-hmm. A child, a man, a woman, whatever, but very soft and not very distinct. And we'll see. It's an adventure in which the wood is kind of, it's telling me where it wants to go.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how far along are you on that one?
I've worked on it for a couple of months. And the last month I've been just very, between getting the show going and catching up on my illustration work, I have maybe... at the end of this week, I'll be freed up, and for the rest of the remainder of December, I'm going to just sculpt on that, and we'll see. I hope to have it finished within 4 or 5 months.
Well, what inspires me is that you seem to be finally allowed to, get at that heart of what you'd like to do more than anything else, and that's what I am, all about in art, promoting that.
Yeah. No question
finding
about
one's
it,
heart desire and making it manifest.
It's been wonderful. It really has.
Yeah, it's great to be able to let it out.
Yes. Yeah.
And especially after all those years of disciplined output, because the skills are there and the sensibility is there, and you don't have to wonder where it comes from.
I don't have to please anyone but me, and that's the bottom line. That's really good.
So. Well, I want to thank you, Barry. I want everyone that's been listening, if they even tuned in at the end, to know that we've been interviewing Barry Ross, and it's been a pleasure to have you on the show.
And if it's still December 2010, come on down to the gallery and take a look at Awakening.
Thank you, Bill.
You're welcome.
Listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.